An Osho Talk. The Divine Melody. Talks on the Songs of Kabir, number 8.
First question. I want to become a sannyasin. But what will happen then? Nothing, sir, nothing in particular. Exactly nothing. That's the commodity I deal in. Literally, it is much ado about nothing. But the nothing is not just nothing. It is the source of all. Sannyas means you are tired of being yourself and you are ready to drop that burden. You are tired of being and you would like to rest in non-being. Sannyas is a state of non-being. You drop yourself and you enter the realm of nothingness. And suddenly everything is beautiful. Because things were ugly because of you. They were not ugly in the first place. Not ugly themselves. It was your interpretation. You were corrupting them. Now the corrupting agent is no more there. Eyes are clear. And one can see through and through. One's vision is transparent. You disappear in sannyas. And the moment you disappear, immediately, instantly, God appears. When you are not, God is. So sannyas is not a way to decorate your being. Sannyas is utterly destructive. I annihilate you. In the old Eastern scriptures it is said, the master is a death. The master is the greatest death. But only through death new life becomes possible. Greater the death, greater the resurrection. Let me be your cross. Die in me so that you can be reborn. You ask what will happen if you take sannyas. This question arises out of fear, out of greed. You would like to be certain, promised, what will happen. If I promise you anything, that very promise will become the barrier, then sannyas will not happen. Because to whom I am promising? To you. To your greed, to your ambition, to your desire, to all that nonsense I am promising. And that whole nonsense has to go. Not even a bitch can be allowed to remain. Even a bit remains, that's enough. Ego is like cancer. You have to utterly annihilate it. Even if a small part remains somewhere, it will grow again. And cancer grows fast. Kamal has sent me a beautiful anecdote. I would like you to meditate over it. Once Mulla Nasruddin came home, as usual, very drunk. His wife was in a rage, more so because he has just promised the other day that he is trying to leave his habit by and by. And the wife said, "Now what about your leaving the habit?" Mulla said, "He had tried his best to break the habit, but when he cut H from the word habit, still a bit remained. When he cut A, still bit remained. And when he cut B, still it remains." Ego is like that. You go on cutting. A bit remains. Bit remains. It remains, but it remains. And this desire to be certain what is going to happen is an effort of the ego, even to survive sannyas. No, I cannot promise you. You are to go totally. Then something is going to happen. But you cannot even conceive it, what it is. It is just like a blind man asks, "What is going to happen when my eyes will be operated and I will be able to see? What is going to happen? Tell me. Otherwise, I am not going to take this operation. Let me first be certain. Let me feel what is going to happen." What can you say to the blind man? Can you say you will be able to see colors and the rainbow and the butterflies and the flowers? You will be able to see light, light playing on water, sun rays being reflected by dew drops. He will say, "What you are talking is all nonsense. I don't know what you are talking about. Talk sense." Because to a blind person, to talk in the language of those who have eyes is nonsense. I cannot say to you what is going to happen. And whatsoever I say, you will not be able to understand. And whatsoever you can understand is not going to happen. Hence, trust is needed. Sannyas is not a conversion. It is a quantum leap in trust. Sannyas is a gambling. It is not a bargain. I can say only one thing, you will not be there. Something will be there, call it X. Old religions call it God. Buddha calls it Nirvana. Jesus calls it Kingdom of God. But all those words are meaningless to you. Kingdom of God? Talking about a rainbow? To a blind man, talking about Beethoven's symphony to a deaf man, no, it does not carry any meaning. I cannot say what is going to happen. The only meaningful word that I can say is nothing is going to happen, exactly nothing. But remember, nothing does not mean nothing. It means the source of all. That's what Buddha's word Nirvana means. Nirvana means nothing. Nirvana simply means you will cease to be. You will not be there. The word nirvana means exactly when you put off a candle, when you blow a candle off, and if somebody asks where the light has gone, what you will say? You will say it has disappeared into nothingness. It is no more. It is lost into the whole. To put a candle off, to blow a candle off, is the literal meaning of the word nirvana. Sannyas is a readiness to be put off. The candle that is burning in you, the candle of ego, will no more be there. Instead of it, there will be a tremendous space. But that space is not known to you. It is not your experience. You can see it in my eyes if you try. You can feel it in my presence if you allow. But to say anything about it will not carry meaning. It will become philosophy. It will not be truth. Truth uttered becomes false. Not because it is uttered, but because those who will hear it are bound to misunderstand it. Either they know it, then they can understand it, but that there is no need to utter it. Or they know not, then the need is there to utter it, but then they cannot understand it. They can only misunderstand. If you allow me, totally, unconditionally, something is going to happen. Something of tremendous import, immeasurable. Even the sky is not the limit for it, because it has no limit. It is tremendous use. It is oceanic. But if you don't allow to me, then to nothing will happen. Nothing in the sense you know the word. If you allow me, then nothing will happen in the sense I am using the word. If you don't allow me, you can take sannyas. You will be in orange. But the same old ego, now hiding behind orange. Maybe the ego will become more strengthened even. I have heard an organ grinder appeared beneath Mess Cagney's window one morning and began to play the famous intermezzo. He played at such a fast tempo that the composer could not stand it. Rushing to the street, Mess Cagney seized the handle of the instrument and turned it at the proper speed, explaining to the bewildered organ grinder that since he had composed the piece, he wished it to be played correctly. The next morning, the organ grinder appeared outside the composer's house with a huge sign in front of his organ which read, "Pupil of the celebrated Mess Cagney." So if you don't allow me, this will happen. You will have a huge sign, "Pupil of so-and-so, a disciple of so-and-so." But the sign will only be a new injection of vitality to the dying ego. It depends. Because when you take sannyas, two persons are involved. I am involved and you are involved. So what will be the outcome depends on us both, me and you. If you allow me, then nothing will happen. Nothing in the sense of vastness, out of which everything arises, in the sense of God. If you don't allow me, then too nothing will happen, in the sense you know the world, or even something can go very much wrong. You can become a new egoist, the ego of the sannyasi, the ego of the meditator, the ego of the righteous, the ego of the knowers. So it depends. If you are really going to take sannyas, then let it be in my way, not in your way. Because in your way, it only appears that it has happened, it has not happened. It can happen only in my way. In fact, you cannot take sannyas, you can only allow me to give it to you. Second question, why do I still not trust you? First, a parable. Meditate over it. It will reveal mysteries to you about how the mechanism of mind functions. There is a story that when the great library of Alexandria was burned, one book was saved. But it was not a valuable book. And so a poor man who could read a little bought it for a few coppers. It was not very interesting. Yet there was a most interesting thing in it. It was a thin strip of vellum on which was written the secret of the touchstone. The touchstone was a small pebble that could turn any common metal into pure gold. The writing explained that it was on the shores of the Black Sea, lying among thousands and thousands of other pebbles which looked exactly like it. But the secret was this: the real stone would feel warm while ordinary pebbles are cold. So the man sold his few belongings, bought some simple supplies, camped on the seashore and began testing the pebbles. This was his plan. He knew that if he picked up ordinary pebbles and threw them down again, because they were cold, he might pick up the same pebbles hundreds of times. So when he felt one that was cold, he threw it into the sea. He spent a whole day doing this, and there were none of them the touchstones. Then he spent a week, a month, a year, 3 years, but he did not find the touchstone. Yet he went on and on this way. Pick up a pebble, it is cold, throw it into the sea, and so on and so on. Just visualize the man doing it for years and years and years. Pick up a pebble, it is cold, throw it into the sea. From morning to evening, for years and years. But one morning he picked up a pebble and it was warm. And he threw it into the sea. He had formed the habit of throwing them into the sea. You understand? And habit made him to do it when at last he had found the touchstone. Poor fellow. That's how mind functions. trust is a touchstone. Very rarely you find a man in whom you can trust. Very rarely you find a heart who is warm, loving, in whom you can trust. Ordinarily, you find peoples who look like the touchstone, almost alike, but all are cold. Year in, year out, from the very childhood, you pick up a pebble, you feel it is cold, you throw it into the ocean. One day, it is a very rare phenomenon, you come across a real touchstone. You pick it up, it is warm, but still you throw it. Then you cry and weep. Then you cannot understand how it happened, but it is a simple mechanism. From the very childhood, you are brought up to mistrust. You are brought up in such a way that you cannot trust. Doubt has been put deep into your being. In fact, it is a survival measure. If you don't doubt, you will not be able to survive. You have to look at the world with hostile eyes, as if everybody is your enemy. Nobody is warm. Nobody is a touchstone. You cannot even trust your own parents. And the child comes by and by to know that nobody is there who can be trusted. The parents are very contradictory. They say one thing, they do another thing. The child feels confused. It is very difficult for the child to figure it out, what the mother really wants. In fact, the mother herself does not know. And the child again and again feels that it is impossible to trust anybody. Just the other day, I was reading a memoir. An old woman relates one incident of her youth when her first child was born. And the child was very curious, as children are. And one day, the child asks, "Mummy, what is marriage?" He was looking into a book, a colored book of pictures, in which the word marriage he had come across. He became very much curious. He says, "What is marriage?" And the mother said, "Marriage is a tremendous experience of love, intimacy, joy, delight into each other's being. Living in love with a person, with joy and celebration, is marriage." The child became very much puzzled. The mother said, "Why you are so much puzzled?" So the child said, "That means you are rarely married. Once a while only. Months pass. Then rarely there is a moment I see you and daddy happy. Married. Just this morning you were not married. You were nagging and he was shouting." Now how to convince this child? What the mother has said goes contrary to her own life pattern. She has explained marriage as an experience of love, delight, sharing. And she may not have been even aware what she is saying. And now the child is puzzled. No, even your own mother cannot be trusted. Your father goes on saying to you, "Be truthful," and you find him 1,001 times that he is untruthful. Even he tells to the child to go and tell the beggar who is knocking on the door that the daddy is not at home. And the child is puzzled, and he goes on saying that be truthful, never lie. And he is lying. How to trust? And the child asks, is there God? And the father says with tremendous confidence, yes, there is. God created the world. And one day or other, the child discovers that my father has not known. He simply deceived, bluffed. He himself is searching. He has not known God. He has not known that God has created the world. Mistrust is born. Feeling again and again the cold pebbles, you become accustomed to throw them. Then, not only this happens, even a deeper danger arises out of it. Mistrusting everybody who is around you, your teachers, your parents, your friends, neighborhood, society, the priest, the politician, all are cheating. All are deceiving. Nobody can be trusted in this world. This conclusion sooner or later dawns on the child's mind. Then even a greater damage has been done. He cannot even trust himself. Why? Because whatsoever he does according to his nature is never liked by anybody. Whatsoever he does according to his feel is always wrong, found to be wrong. He wants to go out and play with the children. And the mother says, do the homework. If he trusts his own feeling, he has to go out and play. But that is dangerous. The mother will be angry. And tomorrow in the school, the teacher will be angry. And the punishment of it all. He cannot trust his own feel. So he forces himself to sit there and do the homework. When he wants to sing, he cannot sing. When he wants to play, he cannot play. And whatsoever he wants, everybody seems to be against it. There seems to be a conspiracy. By and by, he comes to know that if I do my thing, I am punished. If I don't do my thing, I am rewarded. How can one trust oneself then? Dangerous. So first he loses trust in others, then he loses trust in himself. That's why it is difficult to trust. You are now in a situation which goes against your whole life pattern. When you come to a master, you have come to a touchstone. And nothing can happen with a master unless you trust, and unless you trust unconditionally. Nothing is possible. Unconditional trust is a basic condition. Now your whole life is against it. Many times you will miss, that is natural. Nothing to be worried about. Many times you will be lost into your doubt. Remember, come back again. Hold the thread of trust again. By and by, as you have learnt mistrust, you will have to unlearn it. As you have learnt mistrust, you will have to learn trust too. And to learn mistrust is easy because it is very ego-fulfilling. To learn trust is more difficult because it is very ego-shattering. trust brings in your life a new breeze, a new opening, a new door. You have not traveled that way ever. You have not moved in that direction ever. You are not acquainted, familiar. You are moving into the strange. Fear arises. And you cannot trust yourself either. Otherwise, there will not be so much fear. If you had trusted yourself, then you can have a try. Then you can have a certain confidence in you. Even that is not there. Trust as such has simply disappeared from your life. That dimension is closed. So your mind will find 1001 arguments against trust. You cannot trust anybody. How can you trust me? I am outside you. I am part of the outer world, as your parents were, the society, the priest, the politician. You cannot trust Christ if you come across him, because how to trust him? He is outside you. You cannot trust Buddha. And you cannot trust yourself. Otherwise, you can take a little risk. I have heard Mullah Nasruddin limped into the doctor's office with a badly swollen ankle. "Goodness, man," said the doctor, after looking at Nasruddin's ankle, "how long has it been in this condition?" "About 3 months," said the mullah. "Why, this ankle is broken," said the doctor. "Why didn't you come to me right away?" "Well, I sort of hesitated," said the mullah, "because every time I say anything is wrong with me, my wife insists that I stop smoking. Anything wrong with me." And she immediately jumps on me and says, "Stop smoking." So I hesitated. Now the ankle has nothing to do with smoking. But wives are wives and husbands are husbands. And parents are parents. And the society is society. Any time in your life have you any remembrance when trust was helpful? Any time do you remember when trust was beneficial? Always, whenever you trusted, you were deceived. By and by, you lost confidence in your own trust, in your own being. In fact, I don't see a problem why you can't trust. The miracle is that you have come across a person where the problem has arisen. Why you can't trust? This is a great indication that now you have started thinking about trust. That a desire to trust is arising. That the seed is sprouting. I have heard the Irish army platoon got lost on maneuvers in Kerry. The sergeant called out to a passing local, "How much further to Dingley?" 2 miles," was the reply. They marched on, and after an hour, the sergeant asked another man how far they had to go to Dingley. 2 miles," came the answer again. After another hour, they asked again, and the reply this time was still 2 miles. For a moment, the sergeant looked depressed. Then, wiping the perspiration from his face, he straightened his back. "Come on, men," he ordered, "at least we are holding our own." I am happy that at least the question arises. At least you have not lost the inquiry about trust. That's enough. Now much is possible if you insist on this query again and again. If you go on inquiring into situations where you allow trust, in the beginning it will be difficult, just because of old habits. Once it starts happening, little by little, inch by inch, you will be filled with so much warmth that you will be able to risk more and more. Only by experiencing it, you will gather courage. And one day, one can risk all for trust. Because through trust is God, through trust is love, through trust is all that is beautiful, through doubt, nothing but misery, through doubt, nothing but darkness, through doubt, nothing but nightmares, through doubt, nothing but hell. The choice is yours. The society has done its work. It has corrupted you deeply. Now there is no need to go on weeping on the spilled milk. There is no need to cry on it. Whatsoever has happened, has happened. But it can be undone. You have to take a conscious note of it and start working on it. That is the greatest thing in life to work for. Trust opens the door for the unknown. Trusting me, you will learn to trust yourself. It looks paradoxical. When I say trusting me, you will be able to trust yourself. Because trusting me, for the first time, you will start tasting what trust is and how beautiful, what a benediction. The master is just a via media. He simply gives you a situation where you can taste what trust is. And by and by, he will throw you back to yourself. I am not here to make you cripples. And I am not here to function as your crutches. I am not going to carry you on my shoulders. I am not interested in that type of work at all. Trusting me, I simply want you to give a taste of this beautiful nectar. Through it, you will be able to walk on your own. Through it, you will be able to trust others. Through it, you will be able one day to trust life itself. That day you become religious. Not trusting in Quran, not trusting in Bible, not trusting in Gita, you become religious. You become religious when you trust life. When your trust is such that you are cheated 1,001 times, but still you go on trusting. Because to be cheated is nothing. To lose trust is all. One can be deceived. I am not saying that when you trust, you will not be deceived. No, never. I am not saying you may become more of a victim and many people will deceive you. I am not promising that when you trust, nobody is going to deceive you. That is nonsense. In fact, people may deceive you more. But now you know that being deceived is better than losing trust. Because trust gives you the eternal. And even if you are not deceived, what you are going to save? A little money, a house, this and that. And death will take them away anyhow. So what is the fear? Just for these small things, you throw trust, you throw prayer, you throw love. You say, how I can love when people are so deceiving? Let them be deceiving. What they can deceive, what they can rob, what you have got, so they can rob. They can take away your money, something you used to purchase. But if trust is left, you will have your soul. And that is the kingdom of God. The third question. Some days I feel like a Swami and others like a Ma. Can I be both? Or will I grow up the Sisi? Everybody is both. And you have become aware, that's very good. That's a great insight into your being. Everybody is both. The difference between a man and a woman is not much. The difference is only of degree, quantity, not of quality. A woman may be 60% woman and 40% man. Or maybe just 51% woman and 49% man. And so is the case with men. It is only a question of percentage. But both exist in you. You come from both, from your father and from your mother. They both have contributed to you. Men and women are not just men and women. They are bisexual. They are a meeting place of both the sexes. The polarity is there. So no woman is just a pure, simple woman. If you understand this, your life will become more clear to you. In some moments, a woman is more of a man than of a woman. And so is the case with men. In some moments he is very feminine. In some moments he is male, in some moments he is female. There are soft moments and there are hard moments. There are aggressive moments and there are receptive moments. But up to now, the society has been conditioned in such a way. We have been taught and brought up in such a way that man is man, woman is woman. This is a very false arrangement, untrue to nature. If a man starts crying and weeping, people start telling him, don't weep like a woman, don't cry like a woman, don't be sissy. This is nonsense. Because a man has as much tear glands in his eye as a woman. If nature had not meant for him to cry and weep, then there would have been no tear glands. Now this is very repressive. If a girl starts behaving like a man is ambitious, aggressive, people start thinking that something is wrong. Hormonal, something is wrong. They call him a tomboy. She is not a girl. This is nonsense. This division is not natural. This division is political, social. Women have been forced to play the role of women 24 hours. And men have been forced to play the role of men 24 hours, which is very unnatural. And certainly creates much misery in the world. There are moments when a man is soft and should be feminine. There are moments when the husband should be wife and the wife should be husband. And this should be very natural. And there will be more rhythm and more harmony. If a man is not supposed to be man 24 hours, he will be more relaxed. And if a woman is not supposed to be 24 hours a woman, she will be more natural and spontaneous. Yes, sometimes in a rage, a woman becomes more dangerous than a man. And sometimes in soft moments, a man is more loving than any woman. And these moments go on changing. These both climates are yours. So don't think that you are becoming schizophrenic or something. This duality is part of nature. This duality exists up to the sixth center, the Agya Chakra. Only beyond the sixth, the duality disappears. But the duality disappears in the sense that now it becomes so harmonious, so one, that man and woman carry no sense. In India, we have depicted God as Ardhanarishwar, half man, half woman. That is tremendously beautiful. That seems to be the best image ever invented of God. Half man, half woman. That's how it should be. When you reach to the seventh, to the ultimate growth in your being, you will neither be a man nor a woman, are both together in such harmony that there will be oneness. But before that, the duality continues. Nothing is wrong in it. Don't be afraid of it. Because if you become afraid, you will start repressing. And any part repressed is a hindrance, is a block towards the ultimate growth. No part should be repressed. No part should ever be rejected and denied. All has to be made part of the organic unity. Each part of you has to meet and merge into the other, that the conflict disappears and you become an orchestra. And this is happening on each center. Look, our divisions are all false divisions. On the tree, on the apple tree, there is one apple. You say it is outer than you, outside than you. It is not inner. Certainly not. It is hanging on the tree. You eat it. You have eaten the outer. You digest it. It becomes your blood, your bone, your marrow. It will turn into your dreams, into your poetry, into your painting. Now it is no more outer. It has become part of the inner. The outer has dissolved into the inner. Then one day you die. And the earth will use it, your body, as a manure. And again, in the apple tree, one apple will be born. Now the inner has become the outer. The inner and the outer are continuously meeting and merging into each other. The demarcation is only utilitarian. It is not real. Where the inner ends and the outer begins? Can you tell me? Can you make a line exactly clear where? The outer is continuously moving into the inner. You are breathing in. And the inner is continuously moving into the outer. You are breathing out. There is no demarcation between the outer and the inner. They are one. In the same way, there is no demarcation between the lower and the higher. But people have mad ideas of demarcations, categories. Even people think that the lower body is lower and the upper body is higher. Just because the lower body is lower, they think it is lower as a value. Nonsense. Because your blood continues to flow around the body. The same blood goes to the feet, the same comes to the head. Your oxygen goes on being divided all over the body. You eat and the food is digested by the whole body, not the lower and the higher. The lower and higher are two aspects of the same reality. And so is about the man and woman. And if you look deeply, then all duality is just a human categorization to understand things. Arbitrary is the categorization. Otherwise, everything is part of everything else. This whole existence is one. That is the meaning of Kabir's singing again and again. Wherever you find the one, touch the feet. Wherever you find outer and inner meeting, the higher and lower meeting, the material and the God meeting, wherever one is present, bow down, surrender to it. You are closer to reality when you are closer to the one. That's why I say the true sage will not be an escapist, because for him there can be no world and the other world. For him this sore is the other sore. He will be in the world and not of the world. He will be a lotus flower in the water and yet untouched by it. For him there is no division. In fact, for him there is no division in good and bad, moral and immoral, God and devil. All divisions are part of one organic existence. Good insight has happened to you. Don't lose it. And don't be worried that you are going schizophrenic. Up to the sixth, the division remains and becomes more and more clear-cut. And one will feel again and again changing, sifting. It is a sift. Few hours you are man, few hours you are woman. If you watch it exactly, you can exactly know how many minutes you are a man and how many minutes you are a woman. It is a periodical change. In yoga, they have worked hard on these inner secrets. If you watch your breath, that will exactly give you the time. One nostril, the left nostril, when it is breathing, you are feminine. When the right nostril is breathing, you are male. And near about 48 minutes, they change. Continuously, day, night, this change happens. When you are breathing by the left nostril, your right brain hemisphere functions. The right is the feminine part. When you are breathing from the right nostril, your left brain functions. That is the male part. And sometimes you can play games with it. If you are very angry, then do one thing. Close your right nostril and start breathing by the left. And within seconds you will see the anger has disappeared. Because for to be angry you need to be in the male part of your being. Try it and you will be surprised. Just by changing the breath from one nostril to another, something of tremendous importance changes. If you are feeling very cold towards the world, then breathe from the left nostril and let your imagination, fantasy, warmth flow in. And you will suddenly feel full of warmth. In Tantra they say never make love unless you have looked at your nostril. Never make love. If the man is breathing from the feminine nostril, then the woman has to breathe from the male nostril. Then there will be real orgasm. Otherwise, love will be just a wastage of energy. Not more than sneezing. You will feel relieved after a sneeze, good sneeze, one feels relieved. But nothing much will happen out of it. If the woman is in the feminine nostril, then the man has to be in the male nostril. And according to this Vatasena, the first real sexologist worked hard into deeper mysteries. He says when the woman is in the male climate, she should be on top of the man. She should play the role of the man. Man need not be always in the missionary posture. That is called the missionary posture in the East. Because in the East it was never known that the man has always to be on the top. Only when Christian missionaries came to East, people became aware that this foolishness exists in the West. So it is known as the missionary posture. Sometimes the woman is in a male climate. She should be on the top and she should be active. And the man, if he is in the feminine climate, should be passive. He should play wife and she should play husband. And then there will be great meeting. And this has to be remembered always. Because there are acts which can be done when you are in the male climate more easily. When you are doing something hard, carrying a rock, pushing a rock, look at your nostril. If it is not in the male climate, it is not good. It may be dangerous for the body. You will be very soft. When you are playing with a child, or just sitting with your dog, feel that you are in the feminine. more affinity will arise. When you are writing a poem or painting or doing music, you should be in the feminine. Unless you are trying to create a war music, then it is okay. You should be in the male climate, aggressive. Watch it, and you will be becoming more and more aware of these two polarities. And this is good that these two polarities exist. That's how nature arranges for rest. When the male part becomes tired, you move to the female part. The male part rests. When the female part is tired, you rest. You become male. And this is an inner economy. One goes on changing. But your society has taught you wrong things. That a man is a man and has to be a man 24 hours. This is too much of a duty. And a woman has to be a woman 24 hours, soft, loving, compassionate. This is too much of a duty. Sometimes he also wants to fight, be angry, throw things. And this is good if you understand the inner play. I have heard a little boy was overheard by his mother. He was sitting all alone in his room, bored, and he was muttering, "I wish I were two dogs, then I could play together." These two polarities are a good inner play, the play of consciousness. This is how God has become divided in you, to have a play of hide and seek with Himself. When the play is over, when you have learned that which is to be learned from the play, when the lesson has been learned, then you pass beyond the sixth. The seventh is neither male nor female. The seventh is neutral. That's why in Indian languages, Brahma, God, is a neutral word, neither masculine nor feminine. It has no gender. It is the merger of both, absolute merger, and in the merger is transcendence. The fourth question, does attainment to the seventh chakra, samadhi, total dissolution of the ego, mean that one no longer is interested in the problems that face mankind? Hunger, poverty, miserable living conditions, little room to develop one's own abilities, talents. In fact, before you have dropped your own problems, you cannot have the right perspective of understanding the world problems. Your own home is in such a mess. Your own inner being is in such a mess. How can you have a perspective to understand vast problems? You have not even understood yourself. Start from there. Because every other start will be a wrong start. And people who are in tremendously confused state of mind start helping others and start proposing solutions. These people have created more troubles in the world than they have solved. These are the real mischief mongers, the politicians, the economists, the so-called public servants, missionaries. These are the real mischief mongers. They have not solved their own inner consciousness yet. and they are ready to bump into everybody else and to solve everybody else's problem. In fact, they are avoiding in this way their own reality. They don't want to face it. They want to remain engaged somewhere else with somebody else. This gives them good occupation. Good distraction. Remember, you are the world problem. You are the problem. And unless you are solved, whatsoever you do is going to make things more complicated. First, bring your home in order. Create a cosmos there. It is a chaos. There is one ancient Indian fable, a very old story, but of great importance. A great but foolish king complained that the rough ground hurt his feet, so he ordered the whole kingdom to be carpeted with cow hide to protect his feet. But the court fool laughed at this. He was a wise man. Said he that the king's idea is simply ridiculous. The king was very angry and said to the fool, "You show me a better alternative, otherwise you will be put to death." The fool said, "Sir, cut out small pads of cowhide to cover your feet." And this is how the shoes were born. There is no need to cover the whole earth with cow hide. Just covering your feet covers the whole earth. And this is the beginning of wisdom. Yes, there are problems. I agree. There are great problems. Life is so much a hell. Misery is there, poverty is there, violence is there. All kinds of madnesses are afloat. That's true. But still I insist the problem arises in the individual soul. The problem is there because individuals are in a chaos. The total chaos is nothing but a combined phenomenon. We have all poured our chaos into it. The world is nothing but a relationship. We are related with each other. I am neurotic, you are neurotic, then the relationship goes very, very neurotic, multiplied, not only doubled. And everybody is neurotic, hence the world is neurotic. Adolf Hitler is not born out of the blue. We create him. Vietnam is not born out of the blue. We create it. It is our pus that comes out. It is our chaos that takes the toll. The beginning has to be with you. You are the world problem. So don't avoid the reality of your inner world. That is the first thing. You ask, does attainment to the seventh chakra samadhi, total dissolution of the ego, mean that one no longer is interested in the problem that face mankind? No, in fact, only then one is really interested. But his interest will be of a totally different kind. He will look to the root cause of it. When you are interested in the symptoms. When a Buddha or a Christ is interested, he is interested in the root. You may not agree because you cannot see the root. You see only the symptom. He is interested, but now he knows where is the root, and he tries hard to change that root. Poverty is not the root. Greed is the root. Poverty is the outcome. You go on fighting with poverty, nothing will happen. Greed is the root. The greed has to be uprooted. War is not the problem. Individual aggressiveness is the problem. War is just the total. You go on doing protest marches, and war is not going to be stopped. That doesn't matter. Your protest marches, everything. You can enjoy the fun. There are few people who enjoy the fun. You can find them in any protest march. You can ask Astha, her mother and her father. Both have been protesters. Anywhere you will find them protesting. All over the world, her mother goes on trotting, protesting against everything. It is fun. You may have also enjoyed it. In my childhood, I used to enjoy it very much. I was in every procession. And even elders of my town started worrying. They said, you are everywhere, whether it is a communist procession or a socialist or a congress. Anti-communist, you are there. I said, I enjoy the fun. I am not worried about the political philosophy. Just shouting is so much fun. I enjoy the exercise. You can enjoy. It does not make much difference. War goes on. And if you look at these protesters, you will see these are very aggressive people. You will not see peace on their face. They are ready to fight. Peace protest march turn into any movement into riots. These are aggressive people. In the name of peace, they are showing their aggression. They are ready to fight. If they have power, if they have atom bomb, they will drop the atom bomb to create peace. That's what all politicians say. They say they are fighting so that peace can prevail. The problem is not war. And Bertrand Russell's are not going to help. The problem is inner aggression in individuals. People are not at ease within themselves. Hence, war has to exist. Otherwise, these people will go mad. Each decade, a great war is needed to unburden humanity of neurosis. You may be surprised to know that in the First World War, psychologists became aware of a very rare, strange phenomenon. When the war continued, suddenly people who used to go mad, their proportion fell almost to nil. Suicides were not committed. Murders was not done. And people even stopped getting mad. That was strange. What that has to do with war? Maybe murders are not done because murders have gone to the army. But what happened to people who commit suicide? Maybe they have also joined in the army. But then what happened to people who go mad? Even they have stopped getting mad. And then in the Second World War, again the same thing happened on a greater proportion. And then the link was known, the association. Humanity goes on accumulating a certain quantity of neurosis, madness. Each decade, it has to throw it out. So when there is war, war means when humanity has gone mad as a whole, then there is no need to get mad privately. What is the point? All are mad. Then there is no point in trying to become mad privately. When the one nation is murdering another and there is so much suicide and murder, what is the point of doing these things on your own? You can simply look on the TV and enjoy. You can read in the papers and have the thrill. The problem is not war. The problem is individual neurosis. A man who has become enlightened looks into the deep causes of things. Buddha, Christ, Krishna, they have been looking into the roots. And they have been trying to tell you that change the roots. A radical transformation is needed. Ordinary reformations won't do. But then, you may not understand. Because I am here, I go on talking about meditation. Now you can't see the relationship, how meditation is related with war. I see the relationship, you don't see the relationship. My understanding is this, that even 1% of humanity becomes meditative, wars will disappear. And there is no other way. That much quantity of meditative energy has to be released. If 1% of humanity, that means 1 in 100 people, becomes meditative, things will have a totally different arrangement. Greed will be less. Naturally, poverty will be less. Poverty is not there because things are scarce. Poverty is there because people are hoarding, because people are greedy. If we live right now, there is enough, the earth is enough to give us. But we plan ahead, we hoard, then trouble arises. Just think of birds hoarding. Then few birds will become rich and few will become poor. Then American birds will become the richest. And the whole world will suffer. But they don't hoard, so there is no poverty. Have you ever seen a bird poor? Animals in the forest. Nobody is poor, nobody is rich. In fact, you don't see even fat birds and lean and thin birds. All the crows are almost alike. You cannot even recognize which is which. Why? They enjoy. They don't hoard. Even to become fat means you are hoarding inside the body. That is a miserly mind. Misers become constipated. They cannot even throw out. They hoard. They control even defecation. Even rubbish they go on hoarding. Hoarding is a habit. To live in the moment, to live in the present, to live lovingly, to live in friendship, to care. And then the world will be totally different. Individual has to change. because the world is nothing but a projected phenomenon of the individual soul. No, he will be interested, only he will be interested. But his interest will be of different dimensions. You may not be even able to understand it. People come to me and they say, what you are doing? There is poverty and there is ugliness and you go on teaching about meditation. Stop this, do something for poverty. But nothing can be done for poverty directly. Only meditative energy has to be released. So people can enjoy the moment, then there will be no poverty. Communism is not going to destroy poverty. It has not destroyed anywhere. It has created new sorts of poverty, and greater and more dangerous. Now the Russian is far more poor, because he has lost his soul too. Now he is really not an individual at all. Not even the freedom to pray and to meditate. This is not going to help. This is destroying. These are the do-gooders. Avoid them. And you say, will not there be a little room to develop one's own abilities, talents? In fact, there will be no need to develop, they will start developing. When a man meditates, he starts flowering. If he is a painter, he will become a great painter. If he is a poet, then suddenly tremendous poetry will arise out of his soul. If he is a singer, for the first time he will sing a song that is close to his heart's desire. Now there is no need to make any effort. When you are silent, rooted in your being, centered, your talents automatically start functioning. You start functioning the way God always wanted you to function. You start functioning the way you were born to function. You start functioning the way your destiny wants you to function. You become spontaneous. You start doing your thing. And now you don't bother whether it pays or not, whether it makes you more respectable or not. It makes you happy and that's enough. It makes you tremendously joyful, and that is more than enough. Meditation releases your energies. Then there is no need. And a man who has come to the samadhi, seventh chakra, what more is there possible? He functions as a god. He is a full blown up existence. He has come to the ultimate flowering. Now nothing is needed. His each moment is creative. His each gesture is creative. His very life is grace. But there are people who would like to go very roundabout. They would like to change the whole world first, and then they will come to themselves. But let me tell you, you will never be able to come to yourself if you go that long. I have heard, an old man was sitting near Delhi, and a young man was driving. He came to a halt and asked the old man, how far is Delhi? The old man said, if you go on the way you are going and in the direction you are going, it is very, very far. You will have to travel the whole earth, because you have left Delhi behind just 2 miles back. If you turn, then it is not very far. Just a 2 minutes question. if you go to change the whole world and then you think you will change yourself, you will never be able. You will never be able to come back home. Start where you are. You are part of this ugly world. By changing yourself, you are changing the world. What you are, a part of this ugly world. Why try to change the neighbor? He may not like, he may not want, he may not be interested. If you have become aware that the world needs a great change, then you are the closest world to yourself. Start from there. But there are few people who are very philosophical. They brood and they go and run about ways. I have been reading Leo Rostin's beautiful book, The Joys of Idis. He tells of a great Jewish philosopher, Mr. Sokolov, who had been dining regularly at a certain restaurant on 2nd Avenue, beginning each meal with a dish of chicken soup. One night, Mr. Sokolov called out to his waiter, "Come back here and taste this soup." "After 20 years, demurred the waiter, "you question the perfection of our wonderful chicken soup?" "Come back and taste it," repeated Mr. Sokolov. All right, conceded the waiter, "I will taste it. But where is this spoon?" "Aha," cried Mr. Sokolov. "He simply wants to say that I don't have a spoon." Now he goes such a roundabout. "Taste the soup." Don't go so roundabout. Don't be so philosophical. If you don't have the spoon, simply say, "You need a spoon." The spoon will do. All that one needs is a spoonful of meditation. The fifth question. There are some people at the ashram who act as your intermediaries, translating responses to our letters, giving darsanas, running kitchens, guarding gates, running groups. Are they always open passages for you? How to surrender to them? If this is so, is resistance sometimes appropriate? They are not always open passages for me. They are sometimes hindrances. But that's how I want them to be. If they are always open passages to me, they will not be needed. They are needed to create a certain situation. They are needed to bring your resistance out. And if you are really surrendered to me, you will be surrendered to them. This is my will. And that will help you tremendously. It is very easy to surrender to me. It is very difficult to surrender to Krishna on the gate. But Krishna is me. When you surrender to Him, you will have more understanding of surrender. When it is very easy to surrender, it is meaningless. When it is difficult, it is meaningful. All these people here around me are making everything that I want. Sometimes they are rough to you. Then remember, I want them sometimes to be rough with you. Sometimes they are indifferent to you. Then remember, I want them sometimes to be indifferent to you. Sometimes they seem to be simply hindering you for no reason at all. Right. Remember, I want them to be that way. A young girl went to see a big throat specialist. He specialized in big throats. She had a sore throat, and when she saw the nurse, she told her about it. The nurse said, "Take all your clothes off." The girl said, "I beg your pardon, but I have only got a sore throat." She said, "Nevertheless, the doctor insists on all patients removing their clothes before he will see them." So the young girl went into the anteroom to change, and there was another girl in there, naked, barefoot up to her neck. The young girl said, "This is ridiculous. I have only come here with a sore throat, and I have got to remove all my clothes." The other one said, "What are you complaining about? I only came here to pay my bill." You may find such situations here. Surrender. It may be your throat, but if Krishna says undress, undress, and you will be benefited. It is easy to surrender to me, to my love. It is not difficult at all. You are all for it. But then I have to create few hindrances. These are devices for you. If you use them, you will be tremendously benefited. If you don't use them, you will unnecessarily be worried, in conflict, in anger, in anxiety. It is for you. It is up to you to choose whatsoever you want. Remember one thing, here you are to disappear. That remembrance will always help. So whosoever, in whatsoever ways helps you to disappear, feel grateful to him. And many times, it may not be the gate guards, may not be the group leaders, it may be just you who feels that way. It may be just your idea how you have to be received and welcomed that may be creating the trouble. A tipsy gent dropped a nickel into the telephone coin box, dialed a number with great deliberation and cried, "Hello, hello." A voice at the other end of the wire called back, "Hello, hello." The inebriated one banged the receiver down and bellowed to the world at large, "This phone has an echo." Remember, it is more possible that you look your own face. I provide mirrors here. Don't start fighting with the mirror. I have heard that in 21st century they invented a mirror to reflect your mind. Just as the body can be reflected, someday one is going to discover. So you can just look in the mirror and your mind is reflected. And everybody was purchasing it, and millions of mirrors were sold. But within few days, the mirrors were thrown and broken, and the sales simply dropped to zero. And the inventor was very much puzzled. And the company that was producing this was hoping to earn millions of rupees was simply at a loss. What has happened? First they were selling so fast. Then the inventor looked into the matter and found that nobody likes to see his own mind. So people drop them, sometimes accidentally, but knowingly, very deliberately. The accident was false. Sometimes they distired themselves, sometimes they threw it out, sometimes they forgot in the train, and by and by they all went to the junkyard. Then he invented another mirror, which showed you as you would like yourself to be. And that has been selling and selling and selling. And there is no end. Each person has spare mirrors too. Sometimes if one is broken, it shows you the ideal one, as you would like yourself to be, as you really think, imagine yourself to be. These people are here on the gates, group leaders, money size smelling you. These all peoples are first type of mirrors, and I am not in favor of the second type of mirrors. The sixth question: how did you feel before you were enlightened? Just like you. Just stupid. The seventh question was: I have kissed a Bhagwan frog. How really far out? How could we not gain from it the whole, towards what is beyond oneness even? You say far out? Then you must have kissed somebody else's frog. If you kiss my frog, you will feel far in. Not far out, far in. And the last question. You go on speaking daily, on and on, but what exactly you want to say? A parable. He said, I see. And they said, he is crazy, crucify him. He still said, I see. And they said, he is an extremist. And they tolerated him. And he continued to say, I see. And they said, he is eccentric. And they rather liked him, but smiled at him. And he stubbornly said again, I see. And they said, there is something in what he says. And they gave him half an ear. But he said, as if he had never said it before, I see. And at last they were awake. And they gathered about him and built a temple in his name. And he only said, I see. That's what I am saying. I see. I go on saying the same thing again and again, that I see. The day you will hear it in deep awareness, you will also be capable to see. Nothing else there is to say. I see, you can also see. And that seeing is the goal. In the East, we call philosophy, not philosophy, we call it darsana. Darsana means the capacity to see. When you come to see me, it is called darsana. It means you have come to be with me, to see through me, with me, through my eyes. I am not conveying any message to you. I am simply shouting one thing, that I have seen and I am seeing and you are blind. If you are ready to risk, open your eyes and see, and God is here. Enough for today.